What is up, everyone? Welcome back to the Fitness Stuff for Normal People podcast. I'm Mariana.
And I'm Tony.
And the fitness industry right now, it kind of sucks. It's become something built on unrealistic expectations, aesthetics, and external validation, directing attention away from what actually matters. The bottom line is we're not trying to provide just another fitness podcast, but completely change the fitness industry for the better by giving you the knowledge and tools so you have confidence in applying the best possible training and nutrition into your own lives. Where today we are going to be taking bite-sized topics that don't really need the level of detail that would require an entire episode, but topics that you guys still are dying to understand a little bit more. Today specifically, we're going to be talking about mushroom supplements, the infamous three-day water fast that has been trending like crazy, the science of training to failure and when to use it, and food combining, which is a concept based on the idea that certain foods pair well with others, while some other foods don't when it comes to optimal health and digestion. But before we get into that, if you want to support us, the best and easiest way to do so is by going ahead and giving us a 5-star review wherever you're listening. And you can also go ahead and follow us on Spotify to stay up to date on every new episode that drops every Monday.
And if you want more after each episode, join us over on Premium for just $5 a month. That can't be right. It is. $5 a month where you get bonus episodes every single Friday where we answer your questions. Full training programs like our high frequency full body, our ultimate push-pull leg, or our newest two, our glute growth program or our upper body focus program, giving the chest, back, delts, and arm growth a little bit more of a focus. But don't worry, we don't leave the legs behind in that one either. You also get other sick perks like weekly Legion supplement giveaways, exclusive discounts to companies like Oura Ring, high-end blood work with Merrick Health, and so much more. That's just $5 a month, and sign up is in our show notes down below. What are you waiting for? Go check it out. And a quick shout out, as always, to the sponsor of today's episode, Legion Athletics. From the start, we've worked with them. I know I don't go a freaking day without taking their whey protein, their pre-workouts, their fish oil, and their magnesium and vitamin D as well. They're clinically dosed. Their quality is just unmatched. I mean, it makes sense. 100% of their supplements are backed by scientific review board. This is MDs, dietitians, doctors that review every single step of the process in making each supplement. They're third-party tested, and they even have a no-questions-asked money-back guarantee. So if you want to try something risky, like the banana bread flavor of protein, something that's a little outside of your comfort zone, you can try it. And if you don't like it, just let them know, and they'll give you your money back. No questions asked. You can use the Legion link in the show notes down below or type in code FSPOD. That's FSPOD at checkout for 20% off your first order or double points on every order after that. Tweet, 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 tweet. That's a robin. That's my robin sound.
A tweet?
Tweet, tweet. What sound does a robin make? Hoot, hoot.
I don't know. An owl. I don't like birds.
Hooty, hoot. Sorry for the weird animal ASMR for those. But we're cracking. Tony's got his root beer Olipop. Not a sponsor. Oh, hit us
root
up,
beer,
Olipop.
Root beer and orange cream. Orange cream skull?
Root beer is the only one I love.
Not orange cream. Wait, there's orange. Wait, because that's the only one you love?
Shit. That I love. I mean, I think they have a lot of good flavors, but it's the only one I love.
I love root beer, cream soda, and orange squeeze are my favorites.
Their banana wasn't bad either. I tried that for the first time when we were together in LA. Definitely wouldn't get it again, but it was interesting. I like banana flavored things. So that was good. Oh, I love my Ollie. That's my highlight of my day. I know I make it because I have it at about noon. I crack it open. Gets me.
Y'all have that or a Diet Coke. We're on a budget right now, so it's Diet Coke. Definitely
see,
a
Diet
lot
Coke,
cheaper.
That's for dinner. My caffeine free Diet Coke. Don't touch that either. Oh, if I run out of Diet Cokes for dinner, that ruins my night.
Really?
I'm in a bad mood. I'm bummed. I'm like, I gotta have water again. I drank enough of that during the day. I'm also a little baby. So let's talk about a few topics. I do love these round robins, though, getting to dig in all these things that we don't have time for a full episode on, but that I get asked about so freaking much. So I love pointing people to these episodes because we talk about some hot stuff like mushroom supplements. I'm excited to dig into that. Now we're going to start off talking about this resurgence in a more Mike Mentzer style of training, which is this obsession with training to failure. And we're going to talk about what it is, when to use it, when's too much, when's not enough, because it's not black and white, this training to failure conversation. But I feel like on social media, it's almost made out to be like everything else, right? Just to drive clicks is you should never be taking things to failure and you should never stop short of failure. That's the story goes. But like everything else, there's probably a little gray, probably a little room in the middle where that comes from. But more specifically, I've been seeing a lot more, and I know it's more on my side of social media, I think, than yours. Like we've talked about before, with more of the bro side, I think, is this resurgence in this Mike Mentzer style of training. And Mike Mentzer, if you're unfamiliar, he was like this decent bodybuilder in the 1970s and 80s. He was like good. I won't say decent. He was good. He never won Mr. Olympia competitions. He didn't place first, but he placed sometimes, and he was up there and he was pretty good. And he had this style of high intensity training, or HIIT training, where it's HIIT, not the HIIT that I think most people are familiar with. The Barry's Bootcamp, the Orange Theories today, but HIIT, just high intensity training, where every set he would do in the gym was taken to absolute failure or beyond technical failure, using things like drop sets, stretch parcels, forced reps. And he was training with this style with an insanely lower amount of weekly volume compared to everyone else. I mean, like a lot less volume and a lot less frequency. I'm talking one time a week on each muscle group, sometimes a couple, but where he would only be doing one to two, maybe three sets on a muscle group per week. Meaning if he was training his quads, he would do three sets of some quad exercise, leg extensions, hack squats per week. Sometimes not in the same workout, sometimes in the same workout, which is crazy because whenever we talk about training volume, I think we've moved a little past the recommendation of just giving like the blanket between 10 and 20 hard sets is where you want to aim for. That's not bad advice, but I think it's a bit more of a sliding scale now than we used to realize. But even then, it's nowhere close to talking about as little as three sets per week on a muscle group. That's almost crazy. But this thought process of taking things to absolute failure, and we usually recommend, and most fitness professionals recommend, usually stopping somewhere within a few reps of failure, occasionally taking it to failure. So like an RPE 7, 8, 9, 10, or like an RIR reps in reserve of about like one or two, where this guy's taking things to like an RIR of -5 by taking things to failure, cutting the weight down, and immediately taking it to failure again, making it a drop set. So what we're going to talk about is like, is this guy onto something? He had a successful bodybuilding career doing this few sets. Is there something there? And I think to start off, we want to cover, I think, definitions. Communication, we talk about a lot, kind of important. When we say failure, there are two definitions of failure. There's absolute failure and there's technical failure. Absolute failure, or muscular failure is sometimes what it's referred to, is defined as when, despite the greatest effort, a person is unable to meet and overcome the demands of the exercise, causing an involuntary set end point. That's the important part, an involuntary set end point. So basically, you don't just stop when it gets hard or it hurts or you feel the burn. You stop when your muscles are physically incapable of producing enough force to move the weight any further. Involuntary. You don't plan to. The weight stops you. That's what absolute failure is. Technical failure. And I think this is where most fitness professionals, I think, more hover towards this definition, is when you can't do another rep with the same form as when you started with, or at least proper form of that exercise. That's what they would say is, okay, as soon as I have to start moving or adjusting my form outside of what's acceptable, that's the end of my set. That's failure point, right? So once your form is altered, that would be considered failure. This is just where I think most people do it. I personally fall somewhere in the middle of those two definitions when I'm talking about failure. I think a little form deviation, I think you'd agree with me here, but yeah. I want to hear your thoughts. I think a little form deviation is okay to help you crank out a few extra reps, or if you're doing things like stretch partials, to really reach closer to muscular or absolute failure while you're still keeping the same main muscle group at focus. But once you start creating an entirely different exercise just to move the weight a little bit further, that's where I think you're stretching the definition a little bit too far. Yeah. Is that where you kind of, that's where at least I use.
Yeah, that I am the same way. And I also think that that's more common for people, is to deviate in terms of their form, especially to compensate for higher weight, because they think that that might be better. So I just think that's what you see a lot more, but also I'd say it goes against the grain in terms of what people think is best, because it's like, well, if I push this much weight versus my form wasn't the best. People don't prioritize form as much as they should.
Yeah. Like when you see a freaking bench press turned into like a hip thrust bridge, like some sort of thing, like where you're using the whole body to jump the weight up. It's terrible. Yeah. But that's what we're talking about when we talk about failure. Now, we're going to talk about how you can really implement training to failure to really, I think, advance your training further than you normally could if you're just always stopping short. But there's also overdoing it. And to find out where that balance point is, we have to think of things in terms of first and second order consequences. And I know that's a reoccurring theme that I talk a lot about, because I think you have to think about that in every aspect of life. Every decision you make, there are first order consequences or the immediate results of your actions. And then there is the second order consequences. Like first order, again, this is the immediate results of your action. Like the first splash a pebble makes if you drop it into a pond, right? If you eat a lot of candy, the first order consequence is that it tastes good and it's going to make you really happy. You have some M&Ms. Oh, delicious. Right? The second order consequences are the outcomes that follow those initial ones. So think of them as like the ripples from that pebble that go outward afterwards. So continuing with the candy example, the second order consequence would be that you eating too much candy would lead to a stomach ache later, to cavities, a visit to the dentist, weight gain over time. A lot more negative come from the second order consequences. You can't just zoom so far in and only see the first order. And sometimes I think in fitness and health, oh, especially in nutrition, people zoom in on the first order consequence or like the mechanism at hand. And they're like, you should never touch a piece of sugar in your entire life because this is what it does. And they don't look at the big picture. Mm-hmm. So when we look at the first order consequences, and again, this is with every decision you make, but let's look at it when we talk about training to failure. A couple of things happen that are very advantageous for muscle growth. One is you get a lot more motor unit and muscle fiber recruitment and more metabolic damage when you take a set to complete failure, as opposed to just stopping just short, like one or two reps short. Actually, a pretty dramatic difference. And that directly, first order consequence, that will directly lead to more muscle growth. So people hear that and they're like, well, why don't I take every set to failure? More motor unit and muscle fiber recruitment, more metabolic damage. All these things are great for growth. Why wouldn't I make every set like that? But when you look at the second order consequences, what else comes with training to failure? And next time you're in the gym, test this out if you're listening to this. If you're doing, let's say, three sets of bench press to start the day or whatever big movement you've got, let's say three sets of 10, choose a weight that is your 10 rep max, meaning you could not do 11 reps with that weight if your life depended on it. And take it to failure, absolute failure, to where you might even need someone to lift the weight off your chest, right? Take it to absolute failure where you need a spotter. And then do that again for the next two sets. And you're going to notice something. The first set, you probably got 10 reps. The second set, I can almost guarantee you didn't. Maybe 7, maybe 8 if you're feeling good or you took a long recovery. But if that's complete failure again, what happened the third set? You got what, maybe 5 or 6 reps, maybe with the same weight? So, and that's just on a set-by-set basis of your first exercise of the day. Your intensity is just dwindling rapidly, rapidly. And then what happens in the next exercise you do? And the next one, especially if you're doing multiple muscle group exercises in a row, like chest press into a dumbbell incline press or a fly, you're not going to be nearly as strong in that second exercise, that third exercise, as if you were just stopping short, like 1 to 2 reps short of failure. You would notice that you'd be able to maintain a consistently high intensity throughout the entirety of your workout. Meaning if you zoom out on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, you're doing a lot more. And that's what's going to lead to more muscle growth, is doing more. That's what the essence of progressive overload is, doing more. And research is still clear. If you're training within 1 to 3 reps of failure, you're providing just enough stimulus to make that muscle grow. And in a lot of trials, you see equivalent muscle growth in groups that are training absolutely to failure every set versus groups who stop just 1 or 2 reps short. Identical strength and size gains. But I think there's a place for this if you use it smart, right? And this is where I think in like a full body training program, like we have programmed in, I think you can squeeze a little bit more out of your training if you use failure to where you can kind of negate those second order consequences to where it really doesn't become a consequence anymore. For example, if I'm doing, I'll even just say this for like a push day where I start with my chest exercises, then my shoulders, then my triceps. If my last set of incline dumbbell press, which is my second chest press exercise of the day. On my last set there, I'm not going to need my chest anymore. I'm only working my shoulders, my triceps. Take that to failure. Make that a drop set. Make that a partial rep failure to really take things past, because you're not going to need that later. Versus starting off with that when you're going to make the rest of your workout worse, because it's an ego thing. It's a patience thing. I don't really know what it could be. I think that's one aspect to really milk more out of your workouts. Milk more. That was a weird saying. Squeeze more out of your workouts. And then the other, which I've had clients make phenomenal progress, that if you're just one of those busy people who only has time for 25 or 30 minute workouts, doing a full body routine or an upper lower routine where you're taking things to failure every set just because you're only there for 20, 30 minutes, you can make pretty remarkable progress because your intensity is just on a 10 the entire time you're in there. And you don't need to worry about those second order consequences because you're out of the gym in 30 minutes. You don't need it for the second half of your workout. You can completely gas yourself without needing any of those repercussions. So I think training to failure really can next level your training and your programming and your progress if you use it right. If you don't use it stupid and just take every single thing to failure. But this, I mean, we were talking about this, right? You don't see, this isn't as common on your side of things. You don't see this talked about as much.
No.
I love when we compare what we see on our social media feeds.
Yeah.
Because it's everywhere.
I didn't even know that this was, yeah.
I think that's when I brought it up to you. I'm like, what about this for an episode? You're like, I don't think anyone cares about that. I'm like, that is all over my feed right now. What do you mean no one cares about it?
It's so funny.
That cracks me up. So that's where I think it could really take advantage. And especially if you're one of those people who only has 25 minutes one day, 30 minutes, and you're like, I'll just skip today's workout. It's only 30 minutes. What can I accomplish? Bust it out in there and you can get some work done. Don't use that time constraint as an excuse if that's really all you got. Let's train to failure. Anything you want to add on top of that?
No.
That thing that I missed?
No,
I think did a pretty good job. Touched each point. I like it. Now, explain to me and take the lead on this one. The infamous, I think, is how you introed it. 3-day water fast. Because this is where I know we did this episode at Aloe, RIP, lost it. But you didn't know that this was from Gary Brecka putting this on to, why is his name slipping my?
I knew it was from Gary Brecka. I didn't know it was from the fighter, whatever his, is he a fighter? Was he a fighter? Wasn't he a UFC fighter?
Yes, freaking Dana White. Dana White, that's who it was. Dana White posted this before and after, which you weren't too impressed by. I was impressed by for just 3 days.
I wasn't. He had a six pack. So
he did, but I think when people see it, it's in 3 days, it was crazy change. Because I think he lost like 10 pounds is what he said.
But he did me 3 days. In terms of like, I'm biased because people don't understand like, what that short-term starvation is, what it is, like what that does to your body.
But that's why people blew up about it. They're like, holy crap, that was hot for a minute there. Everyone was talking about it.
But so that's why it was so funny to me, because I'm like, what did you expect? What did you expect him to not? You didn't eat a single thing for 72 hours. I get excited about my morning skinny.
And that's where you see people, when anything takes off, like start saying all these crazy benefits where like the autophagy, and it's going to extend your lifespan, and it's going to make you live longer and fight cancer and all this stuff. It's like, that's where I think it got taken to the next level. And people don't know whether or not there's truth to that. Because like, okay, I get that it's water weight, maybe in the weight loss department. Mm-hmm. But what about all the other things that come with fasting?
Yeah.
And is that accentuated by like a 72-hour water fast?
Yeah. So I definitely want to touch on that autophagy piece. That word is thrown around so much and people don't understand what it is. It's used in out of proportion in the fasting community so much. But what autophagy is, it's the process in which old parts of your cells are broken down and recycled. So these can be old parts. They could be parts that maybe are damaged or we aren't providing any function anymore. This is a really good beneficial process in the body. It's happening right now around the clock. You are breaking down cells, recycling them to make new ones or getting rid of potentially damaging ones.
So autophagy is happening right now in me, like as we're speaking right now?
Yes. And what do people usually want to do? They want to enhance things that are good in your body. Of course, that makes perfect sense. You want to do that. But you'll see a lot of claims that fasting has this crazy increase. You see a crazy increase in autophagy, which, don't get me wrong, you do see an increase in the rate of autophagy. So increasing the rate of autophagy, that's good. We want that. We want things that can do that. What can also do that? Caloric restriction and exercise both increase the rate of autophagy. So because caloric restriction does that, of course, fasting is going to do that because that is extreme caloric restriction. It kind of depends. There's different types of fasting. But for 3 days, no food, yeah, you're going to see a huge spike in autophagy. However, there's no evidence that, say, if you equate weekly calories, so you're eating the same amount of calories in the week in both the 3-day fasting group and the non-3-day fasting group, there's no evidence that fasting is better for autophagy than just normal caloric restriction during that week. It doesn't matter if you take 3 days of no food or if you're just slightly ticking back your calories every single day by 300, 400 calories, however you want to do it. There is absolutely no difference overall in how that influences autophagy.
That's what I'm always curious, because that's, I feel like that's what I hear everyone who touts about intermittent fasting benefits outside of just like how it can help people eat less food. They always say how it increases autophagy, but it's like that's never mentioned in other diets. So you're saying it doesn't matter if I just went on a 1,000-calorie deficit 7 days in a row or a 7,000-calorie deficit on 1 day or 2 days. Mm-hmm. It might spike higher during that day, but it levels out. It's lower on the days that it's not compared. It levels out.
Yeah. So the days you're fasting, like say for a 3-day water fast, you're going to see a drastic spike in autophagy. Of course, you're not eating. However, then the next days that you are eating and eating more, you need to refuel your body if you're doing it properly. Autophagy, the rate is actually going to be a little bit slower than say if you're doing caloric restriction throughout, just normal caloric restriction throughout that week. So it evens out. And what does no one talk about? What after those 3 days? Why is anyone more intrigued about that? Why aren't we telling that story? Why aren't we looking at our physique even 2 weeks later?
It's catchy.
This is catchy. 3 days of extremism, going to the absolute extreme. You know what? All power to you if you just want to do it because you just want to say, hey, I did a 3-day water fast. That was sick. Look at me. I don't care. Not judging you. Go do you. Mm. But it is not something that is conducive to anyone's lifestyle. And like, it just it's crazy to me how people will look at these 3 days and think that that's going to change their physique in a long-term standpoint. It's just, and from like weight, from weight loss. I think
it's just human psychology, right? Like it's just human psychology. Like you see that and you're like, oh, that's real. Cause that's where I think the hard part is. You can't argue with someone who doesn't have a deep understanding of physiology, human, like just how we work nutritionally, just everything. It's hard to argue with physical proof. You know what I'm saying? Like when you see someone look that different, it's like to them, that's as real as any study, as anything is, because they see it. You know, I think that's just human psychology, even though it's frustrating because we're like, how many times do we have to beat this dead horse? If it's autophagy, if it's whatever, right? But I'm like, don't you think it's just human psychology is just going to be drawn to like, oh shit,
yes,
that's
and
real.
No. Yes and no. In a lot of times, I would say someone is like, I've been keto for this many months and this is my change. Like, yes, I think that that is where like it's human psychology. Oh my goodness. Like they did this for this amount of time and look at their transformation. That could probably happen for me. With something as extreme as 3 days, three of doing something that is not at all in line with something you would be able to do often. Like, I think that lacks critical thinking or the want to critically think about it.
So just like being naive at that point.
Yes. You don't have to have like, I think that is so extreme that, and this, I don't even want this to come across as arrogant, but for someone to not take a step back and be like, just even question it. I don't even care what it is that you're questioning, but for you to be all in on it, that I think lacks critical thinking.
Yeah.
You don't have to understand.
I was like, going to say, I'm going to play devil's advocate just for fun here. Cause I think people question it at first. I think they question it first. They're like, wait a second, how can this be legit? That's insane. But I think in this specific scenario, it's different for everything. Like the loudest professional seeming voice is someone like a Gary Brecka, who just pulls stuff out of thin air with big words that confuse people, So they're like, wait a second. You know what I'm saying? I feel like to them, it's almost like confusing.
Yeah.
And they ask, and then they see Gary be like, oh, well, autophagy this, and fasting this, and cell overturn, and just all these phrases that people don't understand.
Yeah.
And they're like,
well, then
oh,
that's
shit.
The level of.
You know what I'm saying? That's where I'm like, I think with like, here, because I'm like, he does that to people.
Yeah, but then that's a whole different aspect of deception. Like, you are deceiving the people, your audience.
Oh, absolutely.
So I think when you factor that in, yes, of course, like, of course people are going to fall in line with that. I mean, what Gary Brecka does and what these quacks with no education on the internet do is they know how to public speak and manipulate their audience's emotions and make them feel like there is, I don't know, this makes so much sense. They talk about something that is very vulnerable, like weight loss, or maybe you have some sort of health ailment, something that you're insecure about, and make you feel heard and make you feel like, oh, this makes so much sense as to why I haven't been successful. I mean, they all speak very similarly. There'll be a new Gary Brecka soon, that there will be, but it is so manipulative, and he takes very complex topics, oversimplifies them, doesn't even speak to them correctly, but his audience can't know that. Like,
yeah.
So
absolutely. Sorry to cut off. Derail. Let's get back on real.
I think that, and just one more point from the weight loss piece of just fasting in general can be a great tool to help you get into a calorie deficit. Period. It's not going to be for everyone, but say someone is like, I know Tony, not that hungry in the morning. If he wants to do a little cut and he's going to push back the time he's eating and have a shorter eating window, it's going to make it a little bit easier to be in a calorie deficit. So of course he's going to do that versus someone like me. If I skip breakfast in the morning, I'm going to be way too hungry and I'm going to overeat later. It's not going to work for me. So yes, fasting can be great to get you in a calorie deficit. Whatever gets you in a calorie deficit is going to work. Fasting can work. A 3-day fast, definitely wouldn't recommend that to anyone.
The intermittent, maybe a couple hours a day, but I'm like, the 3-day, I'm like, God, get someone do that a few times in a row.
Yeah. So, I mean, and then you'll say that people say this reduces cancer risk, has a huge effect on Alzheimer's, and they'll reference studies. All of these studies on autophagy and fasting are all rodent studies. So I don't even understand that even slightly, how you can extrapolate that and talk to the general population of human beings and say this is the case. But what you can see is if you are eating in a calorie deficit, if you have lower amounts of body fat, and maybe groups of people have fasted to do that, your metabolic health overall is going to improve. If you are overweight, obese, or even if you're just changing your body composition, your health, your metabolic health, your biomarkers, your blood work, that's going to improve. You're going to be healthier. What you do to get there.
Because I think I asked you this the first time and I thought it was interesting because this was one of the, I want to say final pieces, but it took me a few years in starting to try and utilize research and understand it better. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, when you go through some of the studies on fasting with rodents or rats, and you can see, and these are about to be completely made up numbers, but just for an example's sake, when they take a rat through these extreme fasting periods and they show these dramatic decreases in cancer or chronic disease or something like an 80% reduction in cancer cell from this fasted rat compared to the non-fasted rat. A lot of people hear that and they're like, well, wait a second. Like, are we really that different? Can't we take that? And I think you did a really good job of explaining because rodent data is important. It has its role.
It's so important. Yeah.
But can you explain that to people? Because you did a really good job the first time of explaining why rodent data is useful and what it's useful for, but why it can't just be turned into, oh, this will work for you and me.
Yeah. Yeah. And just for people listening, just so you guys know, in terms of checking my bias, I worked in a lab with rodents, studying rodents in grad school. That was the main form of research that I did. And those were my subjects. And it is so, 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 so valuable. We would not be anywhere without rodent data. It is so important in research without going off on a tangent. However, its main use in nutrition and diet and health and disease is to inform future studies. It's almost like a stepping stone. It's not going to tell you anything about a human population, but it can tell you about the potential, and it can give researchers reason and also go to a board to get funding and be like, hey, we saw this in rats multiple times, meaning there's a lot of potential for humans. You need that rat data to get funding for that. Anyway, side note. Why you can't extrapolate that into applying to humans, the biggest reason is from a control standpoint. Yes. What you can control in a human environment versus a rat in a cage. You can control everything in those rats' cages, in their environment, around the clock. And you do. I used to work a night shift, so I was monitoring these rats around the clock. You can control their diet. You can control the stressors that they're exposed to. You can control their exercise, their water intake. You can monitor their sleep to group them into groups that have similar sleep data versus ones who don't. You can withhold food from them without having outside forces come into play that may also influence whatever outcome you're looking at. Human beings, we cannot control our environment. We can to the best of our ability, but these are things called confounding variables in research that are going to influence the outcome of your data. And just because it's unethical to put a bunch of humans in, lock them in a room and do whatever you want, that is unethical. It's illegal. We cannot do that. It's still, because of our genetic makeup that is so different and unique from person to person versus rats' genetic makeup, there's not as many individual differences. There's going to be some, but the pipeline rats to humans, so different. So thinking, sorry, that was just a tangent, but I feel very strongly
about
it. But it's so
important to understand. But most people don't understand. I was like that when I was 18 years old. I would hear the rat study and I'd be like, holy crap, I need to start fasting. Mm-hmm. I think that's a lot of people because it sounds great, but that's so huge. Like the control, and people don't realize how much the control, and that's where it's easy to pick apart. Even human studies, we were doing that with some training research, looking at different, like that's where like one of the biggest flaws with studies looking at like what style of training might be better for muscle growth or for strength is you don't have a large sample group most of the time. You rarely are controlling for diet, which we know is the majority of what's going to progress someone in one direction or the other. There's so few things that are being controlled. And you just can't translate that without testing it. Mm-hmm. And that's the big piece. I think most people don't have that like full understanding. So I think that helps. I think that's helpful.
Water fast.
3D water fast. So should I do it?
No.
Oh.
Unless if you like want it for the, just like the.
No, I don't.
Hey, I did this effect. Like I did this.
I feel like I just have like the runs for like a week after doing that. Gross.
I don't even want to know what my body would do in terms of that.
Feel like
calm down. Trash. I would, oh my God, no one come near me. Oh my God, when I'm hungry, oh my goodness, no. Like literally, I can't, I think I would probably burn my apartment down. Something bad would really happen.
Like 2 p.m. on day one from skipping breakfast, I'd be like, oh, okay, bro, we got to turn this around. All right, now let's talk about mushrooms. Mushrooms are having a moment. Mushroom supplements, and this is what we're going to talk about, is mushroom supplements. We're not talking about, and in supplements, I guess we're talking about adaptogens, herbs. We're not talking about psilocybin or magic mushrooms, which we do plan on doing an in-depth entire episode in the future on, that people, those are the ones that make people hallucinate, people microdose with. I want to get like a Michael Pollan or a Rick Doblin, the director of MAPS, who's driven so much of this resurgence in psychedelics over the past few years. I want to get someone like them on to really do it justice because it's so freaking interesting on the impact on psychology that psychedelics are having, especially psilocybin mushrooms. So that's for another day. We're talking about more of the adaptogen herb, the cordyceps, the lion's mane, the reishi. This is the resurgence that I'm seeing now. And I think mostly this has been, they're having their moment because of these, I mean, countless people online. I don't want to say influencers or gurus, because I see some more reputable, some less reputable people promoting these things. There seems to be such a wide array of health benefits, boosting your cardiovascular health, your metabolic health, your brain and cognition, fighting disease, dysfunction, improving certain aspects of athletic performance. There's a lot of different directions. And that's initially what rose my first like red flag, orange flag, we'll call it, is whenever something is claiming to do everything, a little signal should go off on your brain. Okay, something might not be right here. But I think that's mostly because the problem there is that people talk about mushroom supplements like it's one thing. Like all mushroom supplements are the same thing. It's like, no, there are very different strains of mushrooms that have very different abilities and have been studied for very different things. So to say mushroom supplements work or are worth taking completely depends on the supplement that you're talking about. So I wanted to break these down into individual ones. The more common ones like lion's mane, reishi, chaga, cordyceps, turkey tail, those are the main ones that we're talking about. They're mostly adaptogens. And that's why I want to lump them not all together, because I mean, we've talked about that. What else have we talked about that with? The seed oil conversation is a common one where people just say seed oils are bad and they lump every seed oil to, okay, eat some pumpkin seeds. Is that bad for you? Sesame seed oil. Find one human trial that shows anything but positive benefits from sesame oil. You can't just lump everything together and say this is good or bad. Now, each mushroom is different. They have different interactions in our bodies and at different dosages, which we're going to talk about soon. And there's some with more interesting human data on and others with a little bit less. And to start, I know we've used the word adaptogen and it's thrown around a lot in marketing. Any adaptogen is just a natural supplement considered to help the body better adapt to stress and exert a more normalizing effect upon that bodily process. That's anything under adaptogen would fall under that. Ashwagandha is one of the most common, most popular adaptogens I think out today. Not a mushroom, mm-hmm. It's an herb, but it's one of the most common adaptogens because it decreases cortisol over and over again in humans. You see this, it's useful at the right times. So we're going to talk about these as we go through. Where non-adaptogen mushrooms, these would be more like shiitake, turkey tail. Those are the ones that we're not going to talk as much about today. But we're going to look at each one. And I think the most common, do these pop up on your radar too much? Are there any that you hear about more than others?
No. I just heard them lumped all together. Well, I really don't. Like cordyceps, I think maybe. I don't know. Not cordyceps. I'm thinking of Last of Us. Not from a health standpoint. Maybe shaga? Shaga's,
I think it's being put in coffee more, just replacement as coffee. That's a mm-hmm. common one. Reishi mushroom is a very common one. So we'll start there. Where reishi mushroom, the primary benefit is that it modulates, quote unquote, your immune system, which just means it reduces major fluctuations in immune function, keeping things more stable. Also, more human research has come out showing some potential benefit with cognition. And there is actually quite a few human and in vitro, so both human and in vitro or just test tube studies that support both of these actions, right? It's also been claimed to help fight fatigue, but there aren't any human trials done on that, which again, doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And I think that's with a lot of these mushroom supplements that we're going to talk about today. There's not an overwhelming amount of human data on them, period. Where a lot of things that we'll call like scams or things that are just a waste of money, like BCAAs, scam, because not only is there not a lot of data supporting it, there's a mountain of data that specifically shows that it is doing less than nothing. Right, going in the other direction. So that's what I want to make a clear distinction in today with a lot of these mushroom supplements is it's not like there's a lot of human data that's like, no, these don't work. There's just not a lot, period. So the fatigue claim, a lot of anecdotes have been spoken about that. People claim to do it, which honestly, I'm a big fan of. Like if something just makes you feel better, what does it hurt putting it in your routine? But at the actual benefits that have been studied, the cognition, the immune modulation, things like that, the clinical dose is anywhere between 1.44 grams and 5.2 grams per day. So clinically effective dose, to put that in perspective, is how much of that supplement or ingredient is needed to actually notice these benefits. And we've gone into clinically effective dose a handful of times on this, but this is where a lot of supplement companies get away with some real shady stuff. Is they'll list an ingredient that has health benefits at a certain higher dose, but they'll put a tenth or a hundredth of that supplement in their supplement just to list it and say, look, we got X, Y, or Z. It can do all this because they're legally allowed. That's a loophole to kind of get away with that. Taking that little is going to do absolutely nothing. Like the poison's in the dose for everything. If you take 1 milligram of caffeine, your body will not notice a difference. If you take 1,000 milligrams of caffeine, you might have a heart attack and cardiac arrest. There's a dose and a range where you want to sit this. So for reishi mushroom, for example, it's between about 1.5 to 5 grams per day. And this is one common example that I love to point out is athletic greens, just because we poop on them over and over because I love them because they're an easy target. They make our job easy because it points out how shady these things can be. Mm-hmm. So AG1 includes reishi mushroom in their super mushroom complex, which is a proprietary blend with five other mushrooms inside. proprietary blend, just for a quick little recap, we're not going to go too deep in it, is just where a supplement, it's so shady, but a supplement company can just list the total amount of the blend of all the ingredients inside without actually having to list the individual amount of each ingredient. So there's reishi mushroom and there's five other mushrooms, and they don't have to tell you how much of each one is in there, just how much total is in there. And lucky for them, where the marketing laws are right now, you can claim any benefit that is tied to any of those mushrooms, no matter how much you put in it, as long as there's a little smidge in there. So take this into account. The total dose on Athletic Greens of all five of those ingredients, or all six of those ingredients, is only 154 milligrams, where the clinically effective dose of just one of those ingredients is at least 1.5 grams or 1,500 milligrams. So even if reishi mushroom was the only ingredient inside of that blend, which it's not, there's others, you would still have less than a tenth of the minimally effective dose to notice any sort of health benefit. And that's what I've noticed when I looked at a lot of different reishi's mushroom supplements, or supplements that included reishi, is that they'd have less than half of 1 gram in there at most. And there's some that were clinically dosed and actually did a good job, but it was like a 5-to-1, 10-to-1 ratio of how many had this much versus what's actually needed.
And that doesn't surprise me at all, because they're so expensive. The mushrooms are such an expensive ingredient. They're also very, very finicky. So the time of year that they grow, like how you preserve them, freshness. I know, obviously, yeah, powder, but you need to start somewhere with that. You start from the real thing. Such an expensive ingredient. So to get that saves the money by doing, and it saves Athletic Greens money by putting them in a blend, because you could pick the cheapest mushroom and put the most of that one in there. So,
but, and that's what cracks me up, is even then I'm like, there is less than a tenth,
and there's not even
of the bottom end. So even probably where you probably wouldn't notice a difference at the bottom end. And that's just one of the other five, six ingredients. It blows my mind, but that's a lot of these mushroom complex supplements. So when people say, should I take a mushroom complex? It is rare that you're going to notice a complex with multiple different mushrooms inside that all have the clinically effective dose. So that's what I'll say. Where I noticed that you'd actually get the clinically effective dose, not just in reishi, but all the other ones like lion's mane we're going to talk about next, is in that mushroom specific supplement. If you buy just a reishi mushroom supplement, that's where you'll probably get enough to actually see a difference, if any. The complexes were the tough part. Lion's mane, speaking of, is another very common one. This one, I think, is more posed on the cognition side of thing. Its potential to really support cognitive function, including memory, focus, and stimulate something called NGF, or nerve growth factor synthesis. Now, here's the hard part, though. Existing clinical trial evidence supporting these claims is limited. It's not non-existent, but it's very limited. Where one study found that a single dose of 1 gram, so this wasn't over days, this was a one-time drop of 1 full gram of lion's mane mushroom, significantly improved certain cognitive functions like working memory, complex attention, and reaction time 2 hours post-ingestion. Participants, and this is more on the anecdotal side, also reported improvements in mental clarity, focus, concentration, and mood. Those are the things that just weren't tested, that were either not tested or couldn't be tested. So those are more perceived benefits, which again, could be placebo, which is just as powerful as anything. But it's not something that you can say, if anyone's claiming lion's mane does X, Y, or Z, you can't say that it does or doesn't do anything, because there's not much data behind it. I think it's worth experimenting with. I would even experiment with it if I saw the right opportunity. I just haven't taken time to look into it. But some focus, some added clarity through the day, if it was able to provide that, 100%, it might be worth experimenting with. But I would say at least look for the dose between 1 and 3 grams per day of lion's mane. That's a big one. Now, this one is the one I'm most interested about, and that's cordyceps mushroom, which you said was, what was that show?
It's in The Last of Us.
The Last of Us.
The fact that you haven't seen it,
I didn't see it, and I posted about these one day on Instagram, and everyone was talking about it. I'm like, what the heck are these people talking about?
Can you please watch that? Because it's so incredible. It is so good. It is so good. And it was a video game. It is a video game. Made into a HBO series that is incredible. And Pedro Pascal is in it. He is daddy.
Oh, wait. Okay, I do love Pedro. I was like, I promise I'll think about it.
Love him.
Pedro, I might. Pedro, I might. Because it's where it's called the zombie fungus, though, because cordyceps mushroom grows from deceased ant, bodies of ants, little dead ants, is where this mushroom grows from. All cordyceps, which is kind of nuts to think about. If you're eating a cordyceps mushroom or taking that as a supplement, it came off of a dead ant carcass, which is funny to think about.
I mean, now, mushrooms are fungi. Like, it's
creepy. Oh, like up close, a little creepy. But it's thought to do a few different things, right? This is more geared towards athletic performance. So not as much cognition or anything else, which it might be in that area in the future. I know there's some trials going on now, but right now it's more geared towards athletic performance. And it's thought to do this by doing a few things. One is by enhancing your body's ability to generate ATP. We love that. Home player. Adenosine. I don't want to make that too long. It also is thought to improve the efficiency of oxygen utilization in the body, which could be extremely helpful, especially during like cardio activity. A little bit during strength training, but I think more during cardio or high repetition training. Mm-hmm. Also, by an increase of nitric oxide or NO production in the body, improving blood flow and circulation. All things that are very advantageous to physical training. And a lot of things in a good pre-workout, L-citrulline, one of the most common ones, that main goal is to increase nitric oxide production, increase blood flow, which is super helpful during training. You want to get more nutrients, more oxygen to the muscle, shuttle away the metabolic stress. For one example, this was a study conducted by scientists at the University of California, West Coast, rep it out. Researchers found that older adults who supplemented with cordyceps for 12 weeks increased metabolic threshold, so the maximum amount of energy that they could produce, by 10.5%, and ventilatory threshold, the maximum amount of air that they can inhale, by 8.5%. So I want to be careful here. This was in humans. This wasn't showing that it increased their strength or necessarily their running times, anything like that, but it improved mechanisms that would aid in those things. So again, this is not a complete translational study, but it was in humans, and that's a pretty notable increase. Another controlled experimental study from researchers out of UNC or North Carolina, they showed that cordyceps improved oxygen kinetics, aerobic power, time to exhaustion, and lactate levels during high-intensity exercise in a three-week trial when it was taken pre-workout. Now, at the moment, there isn't a ton of other human data on cordyceps, but I've talked about how I used this before when I would train at night, and I didn't want to have a stim pre-workout with caffeine in it because it would keep me up all night. I'm like, it's just not worth it at that point. And I would use it pre-workout, and I don't know if it was placebo or not, but I noticed a strength, a power, a little lift without that spike of energy that caffeine gives, if that makes sense. And that's where I think this is kind of cool to experiment with, is if you are someone who trains later in the day, because what time, if you go to the gym, you're not going at night, I know, but what time of the day do you usually go or get your workouts in?
I usually go at 10.
A.M. or P.M.? Mm-hmm. 10 a.m. Okay, I was like, well, you just said that nonchalant. Right, so it's not something that I think either of us would really see a massive benefit. It could be if you're really going to push like the limits a little bit further in your performance. But I think the real potential is with people who train later in the day and later at night. That's where I could see if you're looking for something, I think it's worth a try, just because if you're dragging at the end of a long day, if you got kids, if you got a long job, it can be exhausting just to get yourself there in the first place, let alone give a lot of effort. So something like that, along with, I would take it with a non-stim pre-workout, like Legion's non-stim. So it still has everything else in there, but that's the one that's most interesting to me out of all the mushrooms so far, is cordyceps. And there's more and more research, I think, going on. That's one of the leading areas with cordyceps, but that's about it on the moment. The last one I wanted to cover was shiitake, which a lot of people have heard that one a million times before. As a kid, it was a joke, shiitake mushrooms, because it sounded like the S-H-I-T word. Now, this one, there's been some research for the cardiovascular health benefits, including lowering like LDL cholesterol levels, as well as their immune enhancing properties. But they contain a compound called lenitin. Totally screwed that up. But it's been studied for its anti-cancer and immune boosting effects. So that compound has been studied a lot. Shiitake mushroom on its own has not. And that's where I think the big difference is. But most research showing that like any clinically effective dose ranges anywhere from 1 to 10 full grams of dried shiitake mushrooms per day. 1 to 10 grams. That's a lot. I mean, you're down a lot. But you could probably get that in like a dried powdered form pretty easy. So the bottom line, honestly, on mushroom supplements, it's exciting. It's hot right now. I wish there was a lot more here. The argument in favor of mushroom supplements goes very traditional. I see why people attach to it, because people in Asia have used mushrooms as a cure-all for thousands of years. Modern science shows us that they have a variety of therapeutic effects. So why shouldn't we add them into our supplements? Why shouldn't we reap all these health boosting benefits? It sounds compelling, but it's just not as crystalline as it sounds. Like, most research isn't done in humans, where it just doesn't have that big of an effect. We talk about this, like, setting realistic expectations for supplements is so huge. Even creatine, which is, I do believe, the most studied supplement of all time, sports supplement, and has proven over and over again, like, have the biggest effect on training. You're not going to see a night and day difference from taking creatine and not taking creatine. It'll give you maybe an extra rep or two on those big movements. And there might be some down the road research more on depression, heart health, things like that. But it's not like you're going to start taking creatine and turn into a different person. These mushrooms, same thing. You might notice a slight mood, cognition, performance, slight emphasis on that word. But it's not going to be a game changer like taking caffeine would be before a workout, or something that really can double certain aspects or metrics in performance. So it's just, I wish there was more cool stuff there. Not to say there won't be in the future, but that's just kind of where it is. I'd say, honestly, like, just spend your money on more reliable, evidence-based supplements before you stock up on shroom supplements. That's where I'd say it right now. Spend your money on the whey protein, the creatine, the fish oil, the pre-workout. If you have a little fun money left over, go for it.
All right. Let's talk about food combining, because this was super popular. I don't even know if it was, like, a little bit out. I would say, like, 2021. Like, you see it recently from kind of, you'll see it sometimes, people being like, if you eat your veggies first and then your meat, the food order is going to drastically change your blood sugar. The blood sugar spike after a meal, look at the difference if you have a salad versus it. That's what I see most recently.
Yeah, your chicken
recently.
Then salad versus salad then chicken.
Yeah. But there was a phase, and her name was Kenzie Burke, an influencer, a YouTuber.
And this was a while ago or current?
This was when it was like, I think it was like 2021. 2021, 22.
Okay, because I'm like, it's definitely hotter in the last few months, but this is, I do remember this spike that
you're
talking about.
There was a huge food combining trend of, like, following the food combining method. And so, okay, it infuriated me. But what is it? All right. It is this concept based off of the idea that certain foods pair well while others don't. So people who follow this principle.
We're not just talking taste. I really want to get that.
No.
Yeah, obviously. Like,
no.
I'm going to put a ranch on pizza.
So let me get to it, Tony. Oh, that was my next point. It's this belief that combining foods improperly, for example, like eating steak with potatoes, can lead to negative effects on health and digestion. So they'll assign foods to different groups, so your standard starches and fruits, vegetables, proteins, what have you, and also they'll classify them as either acidic or alkaline or neutral foods. And specify, these food combining diets specify how you should combine these groups in a meal. So some general rules, just food combining, super simple, right? Eat fruit only on an empty stomach, especially melons.
I've heard
avoid
that. Not the melon. I'm like, I've heard the fruit thing a lot. The melon, haven't. But I have heard that a lot. Don't eat it after a meal, or else just sit on top of the other food and something bad will happen.
Avoid combining starches with proteins. Avoid combining starches with acidic foods. Avoid combining different types of protein. Consume dairy products only on an empty stomach, especially milk. Super simple, super easy to follow, not at all restrictive. This is wild to me. Like, that, you hear all of that and it's difficult, right? Like, it is, that is, those are a lot of rules to follow. So not realistic. But is there any reason as to, like, sound reason as to why people would want to do this? So the supporters of food combining principles believe that because foods are digested at different speeds, combining a fast digesting food with a slow digesting food causes this traffic jam in your digestive tract, leading to negative effects on health and digestion. I'm going to debrief on all of these after. I just want to list them out first. They also believe that different foods require different, because different foods require different enzymes to be broken down, that these enzymes work at varying pH levels, meaning the levels of acidity in your gut matter for whether or not you're eating an acidic food or an alkaline food, if you are eating them together, that's going to be really bad for digestion because they have a different pH. They also believe that improper combining of food causes toxins to build up. All right. So do these claims hold any validity? First and foremost, there is simply, like, I'm not even talking about animal studies. There is simply no evidence to support most principles of food combining. So the original food combining diets were developed more than 100 years ago with much less known about nutrition and digestion. And one of the reasons why there is little to no evidence at all, even looking into this in the first place, is because it goes against sound basic principles of digestion. Goes completely against it. So that's not going to give a scientist reason to look into it, because they already know what they already know the answer, because it's just going against how our digestive system works.
Yeah, it's like the basic human biology concept. Like the same thing of like calorie, even though calorie deficits are studied more and more, like people don't realize it is a physical law. So there's no reason really to test it that much and keep throwing money at it. Because it's just a sound principle of human biology that we know to be, we don't know a lot of things to be true, but there are certain things that you just, if you really understand it, you're like, why would I question that?
Why would I look at, So first I want to talk about this, like, avoiding mixed meals idea. So avoiding meals with a mixture of fats, proteins, and carbs, because our body is not equipped to digest these meals when everything is eaten together. And this is just, like, not at all the case. Our human body has evolved on a diet of whole foods, which always contain some sort of combination of carbs, proteins, and fats. Many foods, single foods, contain a combination of carbs, fat, and protein. The digestive tract is always prepared to digest a mixed meal, so to say, because when food enters your stomach, gastric acid is released along with enzymes pepsin and lipase, which start digestion of protein and fat. So released even if your food contains no protein or no fat, you're still going to release the enzymes that are going to digest those components. And when your food hits your small intestine, the gastric acid from your stomach is going to be neutralized and your intestines are flooded with enzymes that work to break down all three, proteins, fats, and carbs. This just is a process that happens when you eat. It doesn't matter if you're only eating the protein or if you're only eating the fat and the protein. Doesn't matter. Like, you are releasing the enzymes required for digestion when food enters your digestive tract. So that is you are always going to be equipped to digest those components. That is crazy to me. That's the first piece. Then we talk about this pH issue. And this is kind of similar to people who, like, feel like alkaline water is this, like, magic thing.
I was going to ask, I'm like, isn't it the same kind of conversation why people say, you need to drink the alkaline water to alkalize the pH?
Yeah. So it is very true that enzymes need a specific pH range to function properly. And not all enzymes in the digestive tract require the same pH. That is absolutely true. But eating foods that are more alkaline or acidic doesn't significantly change the pH of our digestive tract at all, because our body has many ways to keep the pH of each part of your digestive tract within the correct range. It is very tightly regulated. So, for example, our stomach is very acidic. It's going to stay at around 1 to 2.5 on the pH scale. When you eat a meal, it may initially rise if that is a more alkaline food. But gastric acid is quickly released until the pH comes right back down. Doesn't matter if you're having a very alkaline meal. The stomach acid is going to be released and it's going to go right back down to the acidic pH. And it's actually really important to maintain this low pH because it helps start the digestion of proteins and activates enzymes that are produced in your stomach. And it also helps kill any bacteria in your food. Then you get to your small intestine. So what it does is it adds bicarbonate to mix as soon as the contents of your stomach enter it. Our body's natural buffering system is bicarbonate. It is very alkaline, so it neutralizes the gastric acid, because you don't want acid running through your intestines. And it helps keep that pH in your intestines around 6 to 7. Pretty neutral. Tightly regulated, not going to change regardless of if you're having very acidic or very alkaline food. So the different levels of acidity in your digestive tract, because they're so controlled, it doesn't the acidity of your meal has absolutely nothing to do with the acidity of your digestive tract. It is so crazy that it has no influence on it. Like, it just doesn't. If you eat a very acidic or alkaline food, your body adds more or less digestive juices as needed to achieve the necessary pH level.
That makes a lot more sense, because I'm like, the argument for it, again, is one of those things that sounds, makes sense. Like we talked about, it's whenever someone uses like a super helpful analogy that everyone can relate to a very complicated process like digestion, and they say it's like a traffic jam. Everyone knows of a traffic jam. Traffic jams suck. They're not a good thing. So someone could say, okay, this complicated thing that takes way too long to actually explain, this is it causes a traffic jam when you do this. People are like, oh, that makes sense. I'm going to avoid that. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. The analogy makes sense, but when you break it down like this, it's like it shouldn't make sense.
Yeah.
If you understand how these things work. That the alkaline the conversation is always so funny to me.
Yeah.
Because like your body,
it's your pH in any part of
your like, body's too acidic. You're dying. It's like, bro, you'd be in the hospital right now if you actually out of these ranges too far.
Yeah. Like they'll do in stomach cancer, they'll do tests on the acidity of your stomach. In certain stomach cancers, the pH of your stomach is way too high, which is causes a lot of issues because you can't kill off a lot of bacteria. You can get really sick. More tumors can thrive. Like, that is so scary if you don't have an acidic stomach. It just is crazy to me. It can't happen. That's that. Also, the other crazy one to me is like that this kind of talking about this traffic jam causes food to ferment in your stomach and toxins to build up. So
that's the one I heard about fruit a long time ago, which when I was like, I think 20 years old, I definitely fell for it. I'm like, I got to eat my fruit first or on an empty stomach. I can't do it after. It's going to sit on top of the other food.
Yeah. Because they believe that, I say they, because it is this almost, it's a belief, like group of people that believe in these principles. So believing that when a fast digesting food is combined with a slow digesting food, the fast digesting food stays in your stomach so long that it begins to rot and ferment. It sits there. It's stuck. Okay. This simply doesn't happen. I'm such a nerd. This makes me feel like I'm such a nerd because I'm like giggling. I'm like, this is such a funny joke, but it's not because I'm just thinking about our stuff anyway. But fermentation and rotting occur when microorganisms start to digest your food. Your stomach maintains such an acidic pH that almost no bacteria can survive there. Like, there's bacteria is not living in our stomach. Our large intestines is the one place in your digestive tract where bacteria really, really thrive, and fermentation does occur. Fermentation of fiber. So we actually do not digest fiber. Bacteria in our intestines, for it's fermenting is what they do. That's the type of digestion for them. Ferment this fiber and produce a lot of beneficial compounds. So bacteria fermenting any undigested carbs like fiber is such a good thing. It is so beneficial for your health because the fatty acids the bacteria produce have been associated with health benefits like reducing inflammation, improved blood sugar control, lowering your risk of colon cancer, improving your gut health. So there's a lot of good things that come from that fermentation. So that's the only time fermentation takes place in your digestive system. And it's actually a good process.
Not a bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So
that's funny. Cause I'm like, we've even said and highlighted how that's the problem with so many poorly produced probiotic supplements is that they go straight into another great example of AG1, a powdered probiotic supplement that goes straight into your stomach acid. None of those probiotics are making it to your large intestine where the benefit would actually come from, if any.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So and it's funny because this is exactly where it's like, they're building this thing. It's like, no, that can't happen in the first place. Mm-hmm. It's so funny to me, which I do think the food combining, though, I want to ask you this. This is distinctly different from maybe some benefits of combining certain foods that you might see in terms of like if you're dieting for fat loss, having a meal that has multiple different micronutrients. So like having a meal with protein and complex carbohydrates and a little bit of dietary fat will usually keep you fuller, longer, slow down digestion more than just having protein alone or carbs alone. Yes. Right. So I'm like, that's where it's very different conversation than that conversation. Correct.
Yes. Yeah. And from a digestion standpoint, because this is food combining really prioritizes, I say in air quotes, digestion, there are some people that you know your body best, right? Certain foods that maybe you eat together just because of individual difference, like what makes you feel best might just not work. Maybe you have to pay attention to certain pieces. Maybe you just feel better when you don't have, when you just have your proteins with your veggies, like for whatever reason, doesn't matter. It just, you feel better. That's fun. That's just individual differences in how we digest food. It doesn't mean that that's the best, but for you in terms of how you eat, maybe that might be best. You know what I mean? I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that. Like,
that's where I'm like, I just, that thought came up because I'm like, we've also talked about food combining in a good sense, I guess, before, but this is, just separating.
This is like the totally specific, like food combining diets. That's what they're like. So
that is always funny. So food combining, you shouldn't do it is what you're saying. You should do it.
No, it's going to add so much more stress to your life too.
Nutrition is complicated enough as it is.
Why would you do that?
I'm like, now you're telling me the order of which I can eat the foods I'm eating already, which were hard enough to figure out in the first place.
Like, what if you want an apple with your, after you had, 10 minutes after you had a meal, can't do that. Like, can't
no more
do
apple
that
for you.
It's going to rot there. Like, what?
That is a funny one, but there has been this big resurgence in that coming up. Mm-hmm. That puts a bow on round robin. Boom, boom.
In case anyone's wondering, that was like our third time recording this.
I was going to say that one, it hurts a little bit. That was our third time recording because the first time at Aloe, the files were corrupted, got deleted. Mm-hmm. Last week, this was because we were coming off of the Aloe chaos, both a little brain dead.
Yeah, forgot to
hit the record button. That was fantastic. Great practice that led us right to here today to make a great episode. And we did hit the record button. We freaking made it. So as always, everybody in premium, we'll talk to you guys this Friday for this week's AMA, like we do every week, giving away a couple of Legion goodies over there like we do every week. To everybody else, we will see you back here on Monday. We hope you have a productive little week and a fantastic weekend. Treat yourself this weekend. Get out. Have a little fun. I only told you soon. Talk to y'all later.